Imagine living in a town where nothing is truly yours. The school your child attends has a monthly tuition. Miss a payment, and your child loses their spot. The road to drop them off charges a toll, too. The water in your tap is metered by a private gatekeeper. The hospital wing is branded, sponsored, and optimized for revenue over care. Even the park bench beneath the oak tree carries an ad and a maintenance fee. You don't own a book. You rent the right to turn a page. You don't own the farm. You lease space to grow and pay a toll to harvest. The refrigerator you store the food in has a monthly fee too. And your home, the place that once anchored identity, family, and wealth, feels less like a stake in a community than a monthly invoice for the privilege of sleeping inside its walls. That is the promise and peril of the privatization movement. The belief that everything can be run like a business because businesses are efficient. Sometimes they are. A private operator can patch the roof while a committee debates who's allowed to buy the ladder. Contracts enforce deadlines, metrics expose waste. Competition, when it's real, can lower costs, at least for a while. The idea sells because it offers speed, simplicity, and control. But business is not a synonym for society. Businesses answer to balance sheets. Communities answer to one another. Firms optimize for predictable cash flow. Public goods exist precisely to absorb the unpredictable. The child who needs extra help, the patient who can't pay, the bus route that runs empty at 10:30 p.m. because a night shift nurse still has to get home. Those inefficiencies aren't flaws. They're the point. The truth is, privatization, despite its tidy language of efficiency, has always been political. It isn't just a management tool. It's a strategy for power. Who decides, who benefits, and who bears the costs? In the 1950s, Milton Friedman argued that democratic governments naturally expand, pulled by interest groups, sustained by bureaucracies, protected by politicians reluctant to shrink their own authority. To Friedman, the state was a monopoly, and monopolies breed inefficiency. Privatization wasn't just reform, it was a counterweight. While there's merit in that idea, the privatization movement effectively shrinks government, the power of the collective, without admitting you were shrinking the public's rights. In 1955, Friedman presented the idea of school vouchers. Public money, private delivery. Bureaucracy stays small, the market sorts the rest. He called it choice, but Friedman was clear about the trade-off. Businesses, he argued, owe no duty to society beyond the contract. Even when funded with public money, they are accountable only to owners, not to the public, not to democracy. History tested that idea quickly.
The real fallacy in Mr. Faulkner's reasoning is that this is something new. Desegregation has been coming about over a period of 20 or more years. When Mr. Faulkner or anyone else says, wait, you must bear in mind that Negroes in this country have been waiting since 1863 when the Emancipation Proclamation was put forth. We've been waiting since the 14th Amendment was adopted. As a matter of fact, I would say that the NAACP's more reasonable criticism is that we're moving too slow.
This is Thurgood Marshall on Night Beat with Mike Wallace, broadcasted in 1954 by the Dumont Network. After Brown versus the Board of Education, a 1954 landmark Supreme Court decision that declared racial segregation in public schools unconstitutional, choice became a weapon. White families sought to evade integration through private schools that offered what customers demanded, separation, subsidized with public funds.
The other newspaper in Richmond, I think they're owned by the same outfit, the Richmond News Leader, I think that's the name of it, a day or so after the decision came down, in a long editorial, called on the people of Virginia to fight against integration with all of their power, to litigate for over 100 years if necessary. That was said long before the NAACP even opened its mouth about it.
in Prince Edward County, Virginia, officials defunded public schools, issued tuition grants, and watched white families form segregation academies. They then closed the public schools entirely and locked the doors. The lesson was unmistakable. Put a public good in private hands and the rules change. Discrimination becomes preference. Exclusion becomes choice. Friedman sought escape from government's iron fist. In practice, his model forged another, one fueled and funded by division. Contrast that with Wake County, North Carolina, about 45 years later. There, Superintendent Dr. William McNeil pursued integration by design. Beginning in the late 1990s, the district used socioeconomic indicators to prevent concentrated poverty, balancing income levels, academic performance, and resources across schools. And because decades of race-based policy often mapped onto wealth and opportunity, class-based assignment frequently reduced racial isolation too. The principle was simple: a child's zip code should not decide their future. It worked. By 2003, student achievement exceeded 91%. In 2004, Forbes ranked Wake County among the nation's best large districts, and McNeil was named National Superintendent of the Year. Equity and excellence reinforced one another, an outcome that should be desired as it would likely lead to more productive members of society. But that success triggered backlash. Enter the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Amid conservative resistance to desegregation and regulation, it was founded in 1973 by activists like Paul Weyrich, a co-founder of the Heritage Foundation. ALEC paired corporate representatives with state legislators to draft model bills behind closed doors, then sent them home to be introduced as law, often word for word.
ALEC has forged a unique partnership between state legislators and leaders from the corporate and business community. This partnership offers businessmen the extraordinary opportunity to apply their talents to solve our nation's problems and build on our opportunities. Working together as a team, you serve our nation well.
ALEC brands itself as nonpartisan, but its mission is explicit: eliminate government, free markets, and federalism. Corporate members pay to sit alongside lawmakers and vote equally on legislation. Once approved, those bills spread quietly across the country, rarely disclosed as ALEC authored.
Bills to change the law to make it harder for American citizens to vote, those were ALEC bills. Bills to dramatically change the rights of Americans who are killed or injured by corporations, those were ALEC bills. Bills to make it harder for unions to do their work were ALEC bills. Bills to basically block climate change agreements, those were ALEC bills. When I looked at them, I was really shocked. I didn't know how incredibly extensive and deep and far-reaching this effort to rework our laws was.
This is Lisa Graves, a former Justice Department attorney who is the executive director of True North Research and president of the board of the Center for Media and Democracy, a nonprofit investigative reporting group in Madison, Wisconsin. In 2011, an ALEC insider turned whistleblower provided Graves with a trove of ALEC documents, including actual ALEC model bills. Of the many areas of interest, education was central. Early opposition to busing evolved into a polished push for vouchers, charters, and online schooling, marketed as freedom, structured to fracture public systems, and aligned with for-profit firms like Connections Academy and K-12.
What you see is corporations that have a direct benefit, whose bottom line directly benefits from these bills, voting on these bills in the ALEC task force. And so corporations like Connections Academy, corporations like K-12, they have a direct financial interest in advancing this agenda.
It's worth noting that ALEC's corporate membership also includes major players in the criminal justice ecosystem: private prison operators, security contractors, and surveillance and communications technology firms. Consider that a destabilized, market-driven education system can serve these interests on two fronts. financial gain on pathways to opportunity, while simultaneously expanding the market for incarceration, monitoring, and ultimately a pool of coerced or low-cost labor for those who fall through the cracks. Wake County became a flashpoint because it exposed the lie at the heart of school choice. If integrated public schools could succeed at scale, the case for marketizing education collapsed. Integration was reframed as forced busing. Planning became social engineering. Parents were reframed as consumers. By 2009, the backlash prevailed. The school board flipped. The diversity plan was dismantled. Wake County wasn't undone because it failed, but because it worked. The same logic resurfaced during the urban fiscal crisis of the 1970s. As cities bled revenue, conservatives blamed pensions and social programs. Privatization became the compromise. Don't call it austerity, call it efficiency. Thinkers like Emmanuel Savas reframed citizens as customers and government as a monopoly. Crisis, he argued, was a golden opportunity, not to rebuild the public, but to replace it. The strategy was incremental. Privatize one service at a time, never announce the full destination, because people like libraries, they like clean water, they like teachers who show up. Over time, the argument turned openly financial. Trillions in public budgets became a marketplace for contracts, tolls, and fees. Governments became customers and corporations became sellers. But sellers write the fine print. That's how we arrive here. A world where access itself is the product. We saw it plainly in media. Subscriptions instead of one-time purchase. Then software. Then mobility. Now shelter. But not everything that matters should be gated. A playground's value isn't ROI, it's belonging. A library isn't inventory, it's autonomy. A half-empty bus isn't waste if it's the only way to get home. Through privatization, if you own the gate, you can charge for passage, forever. And once that logic reaches housing, it doesn't just change markets, it changes what it means to belong. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
And then if you look at the private sector and you look at, well, where is there surplus capital sitting available to be invested in that type of infrastructure? Well, the answer these days is pretty much asset management companies like BlackRock.
We believe that there's a need for trillions of dollars investing in infrastructure related to our power grids, AI, the whole digitization of an economy, all these different investments.
Well, they go together, don't they?
They all go together.
Last time we explored how decades of financial experimentation and political complacency collided, and how the government's rescue of the financial elite deepened inequality, reshaped cities, and set the stage for a new kind of housing crisis, one defined by corporate landlords, stagnant wages, and policy capture. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Today, we chart the pivot from selling homes to selling access, how the subscription mindset of the tech economy leapt into housing, how the build-to-rent model matured into a permanent feature of American life, why investors prefer yields to sales, and what it means when rent becomes a platform. We'll also look at a historic transfer of ownership in farmlands. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 8. From ownership to access. In the industrial economy, scarcity created value. A manufacturer built one more refrigerator and earned one more dollar. The business made something, the consumer owned it, and the transaction ended. Credit extended that relationship. Media, then digital technology, introduced a whole new equation. Copying a file costs almost nothing. Updating an app is constant, serving a movie to 10 million screens isn't 10 million times as expensive as serving it once. The product no longer ended at the sale, it began there. So the philosophy flipped. If you can't profit by selling the same thing over and over, you profit by selling the time inside it. Continuous access. Around 2000, software moved towards SaaS, software as a service. The DVD by mail became the endless scroll. The CD became the stream. We didn't stop paying, we just started paying forever. And investors fell in love for a simple reason. One-time sales are lumpy. Subscriptions are smooth. Analysts call it visibility. Forecastable revenue quarter after quarter. Capital prefers rivers to rainstorms. Monthly recurring revenue looks like a river. When Wall Street finds a model that lowers risk without sacrificing return, it hunts for new places to apply it. Predictable cash flows can be securitized, leveraged, hedged, and scaled. If you can turn human necessities into subscription lines on a spreadsheet, the multiples go up. And there is no necessity like shelter. By the mid-2010s, the ground shifted under the traditional development model. Land prices climbed fastest where jobs were. Material costs rose. Skilled construction labor, thinned out by the Great Recession, didn't return at the scale we needed. Permit cycles extended. Every fee pushed the pro forma towards red. The math that once justified build to sell started to fray. So large-scale public builders faced two choices: push sell prices further beyond what buyers could afford, or change the business model entirely. The market's answer had been hiding in the ruins of the last crisis. Foreclosure auctions in Phoenix, Atlanta, Charlotte, Dallas. Investors realized that they didn't need a buyer at the end of every project. They could be the buyer, permanently. Buy in bulk, stabilize occupancy, operate at scale. Package rents into securities. Harvest predictable cash flow quarter after quarter while assets appreciate on their own. That's not a one-time hit. That's a pipeline. It turns a cyclical transaction industry into a yield machine. Once that logic clicked, a pivot followed. What tech had proven with SaaS, convert ownership into service, real estate redeployed into build to rent. This is Todd Wood, founder and CEO of Christopher Todd Communities on CNBC's Power Lunch, discussing the concept after partnering with Taylor Morrison to expand it across the country.
You know, owning a home has always been the American dream and probably always will be. 65% that are renting are under the age of 35. And so we have this huge group of individuals that are renters by choice. If you look at really what our product delivers to them, it's a totally different concept that anybody's ever seen before. What we did was, if you look at the traditional multifamily, which is kind of a vertical environment where people can live in either a 2 to 3 story garden style apartment or even an urban high rise. And then you look at kind of the standard traditional single family rental, which is a home in a for sale community, but it's for rent. So what this product that we've done is, it's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah.
It's right in between. Yeah. It's in the best of both worlds that we bring to the environment. And if you really look at it, we've always said, you know, sometimes you used to drive a truck, sometimes you used to drive a car, but somebody came out and said, you know, let's create something that's in between. An SUV has really done well. So we really look at this product as people want to live in these communities for all kinds of various reasons, depending upon their demographic.
But the concept isn't new. Long before build to rent became a line item in an investor deck, entire workforces lived in homes they did not own, company towns, where the employer owned not just the factory, but the houses, the stores, the schools, even the rules. These towns appeared across the world, from the US to Belgium, Germany, Japan, Mexico, Chile, and beyond, because capital discovered a simple truth. Controlling shelter is a powerful way to control labor. One early example was Grand Hornu in Belgium. After acquiring a mining concession in 1810, industrialist Henry DeGeorge commissioned a neoclassical town to house workers, orderly, efficient, and dependent. When the mine closed in 1954, the town emptied. Today, it's a museum, a beautiful artifact of a system where work, housing, and power were fused. In the United States, the most famous company town was Pullman, built outside Chicago in the 1880s. The Pullman Company was a manufacturer of railroad cars. The founder, George Pullman, offered housing, markets, libraries, churches, an entire planned world for employees. Workers weren't required to live there, but those who did often received better treatment, including higher wages. The system worked until the Panic of 1893, when Pullman cut wages but refused to lower rents or prices. Workers revolted. The Pullman strike of 1894 paralyzed rail traffic nationwide. A federal commission condemned Pullman's control as un-American, noting that aesthetic beauty mattered little, quote, when they lack bread. The strike ended in violence, with 34 strikers dead at the hands of federal troops, and in 1898, Illinois courts forced Pullman to sell the town. But the idea didn't die, it evolved. Industrialists tried again with softer edges. Model towns like Port Sunlight and Bourneville in England offered green space, decent housing, schools, and cultural life. The Cadbury Brothers' Bourneville became a showcase of welfare capitalism, healthier, more humane, and still deeply controlled. These experiments influenced the Garden City movement and professional planning itself, a future where design could soothe conflict without surrendering authority. Eventually, public investment made company towns less necessary. Schools, libraries, parks, labor protections, minimum wages, union power, especially under the New Deal, reduced employer influence. Workers were encouraged to own homes, not rent them from their bosses. The company town faded. Until now. In 2021, Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak floated innovation zones, corporate districts with powers usually reserved for counties, taxes, courts, school systems. Around the same time, Elon Musk pushed to incorporate Starbase Texas, built around SpaceX, which in itself is yet another example of privatizing civil programs. In 2025, Starbase officially became a municipality, with a SpaceX executive as mayor.
There's a new city in Texas, and it's home to the South Texas home of Elon Musk's SpaceX company, as they are now formally, finally being named Starbase. Starbase Texas becoming a city will help us continue to build the best community possible for the men and women building the future of humanity's space place in space. So we're following this very closely as a vote on Saturday to formally organize Starbase as a city was approved by a lopsided margin among the small group of voters who live there and are mostly Musk's employees at SpaceX, with all votes coming to a tally of 212-6. Elon Musk posting on social media saying, now a real city. Starbase is the facility of launch site of the SpaceX rocket program that is under contract with the Department of Defense and NASA that hopes to send astronauts back to the moon and someday Mars. Musk first floated the idea of Starbase in 2021. Approval of the new city was all but certain of the 283 eligible voters in the area. Most are believed to be Starbase workers.
The lesson is familiar. When housing, work, and governance consolidate into the same hands, efficiency, maybe even wages, may rise, but freedom shrinks. Modern build-to-rent, though, is different in scale and mechanics. It isn't just building rentals, it's building a balance sheet. The UK popularized the term after 2008, when government, eager to spur supply, invited institutional capital into large-scale rental projects. Planning flexed, financial supports were discussed, firms like Essential Living, Greystar, and Quintain formalized the category. In the U.S., the path was less official and more opportunistic. The foreclosure wave created a sea of bank-owned homes. Blackstone's Invitation Homes, as we've discussed, bought distressed properties by the thousands. American Homes for Rent, Tricon Residential, and Progress Residential joined the suite. Management platforms standardized leasing and maintenance. Financing vehicles securitized rental streams. At first, it was buy to rent. Then came the next move, build from scratch. Why inherit quirks of scattered houses when you can design whole neighborhoods for operational efficiency? Clustered layouts to reduce drive times, standardized plans for bulk purchasing, amenity centers to justify premiums, pets, parking, and packages engineered the management model. The language shifted too. Home without hassle, not a lease, a membership. Then the pandemic hit. Families fled tight apartments for space, yards, and privacy. Capital poured in. J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Brookfield, Greystar. Builders pivoted. Lennar partnered with Centerbridge and Alliance to build a multi-billion-dollar rental platform. Toll Brothers leaned harder into rental and multifamily. The message was blunt. If your buyer can't or won't buy, don't sell. Subscribe them. This wasn't just preference, it was economics. Wages stayed flat in real terms. Asset prices increased behind the upward force of those with leverage. Rungs were being completely removed from the ladder of wealth and opportunity. So, builders stopped aiming for a one-time exit and started aiming for consistent, ongoing revenue. Once you manage 10,000 homes, you're not a builder, you're infrastructure. And once you're infrastructure, you don't need a boom. You need tenants not to move. A technical shift made that more feasible. Cloud infrastructure and frictionless payments and operations. AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud rewired how services are delivered. Updates became invincible. Billing became automatic. APIs stitched platforms together like Legos. Housing followed. Leasing portals, instant background checks, dynamic pricing, smart locks, resident experience apps that route maintenance, manage amenities, track package lockers, and quietly harvest data, occupancy patterns, renewal probabilities, rent sensitivity. SaaS had taught the playbook. Instrument everything, learn constantly, reduce churn. Rent now lives in a dashboard. The model shift had cultural winds at its back too. Supply constraints tightened like a vice. Trades retired and apprenticeships lagged as a generation was steered toward the credential economy after manufacturing and labor were shipped overseas. At the same time, millennials and Gen Z came of age under student debt, another prey of financialization. Obligation aggressively sold as opportunity that became an anchor. I recall private loan and credit card companies camped out on my campus, trading freebies for applications. The debt, non-negotiable and unforgivable, followed people across state lines, limiting where they could live, what jobs they could take, and how far they could move. Mobility slowed. Risk became unaffordable. Starter homes appreciated out of reach, and the gig economy and side hustles fractured salaries into hours that never add up. In that world, flexibility isn't always a perk. It can be wreckage, the last thing you grab to breathe in a turbulent sea just before you go under. Marketing reframed it as aspiration, curated life without the quote burden of ownership. The dog park that used to be a city's job is now an amenity. The pool that used to require a public vote is now bundled into rent. The dream pivoted from roots to mobility, from equity to access. And access is billable. Meanwhile, zoning locked vast neighborhoods into single-family sprawl, permitting queues stretched. Land near jobs became scarce, then prohibitively expensive. When interest rates rose in 2022, they hit like a final blow, sending mortgages and construction loans soaring and freezing what little new housing could still be built. In a world where adding supply is hard, scarcity becomes valuable. If you can't build enough for everyone to own, you can profit by owning what everyone must rent. Predictable returns, tax benefits, inflation pass-through, fees stacked atop base rent, parking, pet rent, trash valet, smart home packages. Scarcity is no longer the problem to solve. It's the moat to defend. That's the inversion. The obstacle became the opportunity. Pre-2008, institutional ownership of single-family rentals was negligible. By 2020, it had climbed into the hundreds of thousands. By 2023, roadmaps projected doubling again. Read the filings. Pensions rebalanced toward core income. REITs sold housing as a service. Builder earnings calls highlighted rental divisions. Housing isn't unique. When new sales flatten, industries rewrite how they get paid. Automakers push leases and subscriptions. Telecom shifted to monthly plans. Software became SaaS. Media swapped own this for access everything. The logic is identical. If customers can't or won't swallow ownership costs, offer controlled access priced just below paying. The outcome is identical too. Lower volatility, higher valuations, deeper dependence. As we discussed, Airbnb contributed technology to the shift as well. Recurring users generate recurring data. In tech, that improves the product. In housing, it improves the portfolio. What units rent fastest? What amenities justify premiums? What layouts reduce repairs? What policies lower churn? Data refines underwriting. Underwriting sets valuation. Valuation draws capital. And capital buys more homes. That's the flywheel. Economist Brett Christophers highlights a broader pattern, rentier capitalism. Profits made not by making things, but by controlling gateways.
Governments around the world, not just in New Zealand, have identified a whole series of investment demands relating particularly to infrastructure. And I know you were just talking about infrastructure just now, not least relating to climate infrastructure, infrastructure of climate mitigation and adaptation. And as well as recognizing a huge demand for investment, I think the second important part is that governments have increasingly accepted or taken the view that governments themselves shouldn't be undertaking that investment. It shouldn't be principally or even at all public money. So they're looking to the private sector to undertake most of that investment. And then if you look at the private sector and you look at, well, where is their surplus capital sitting available to be invested in that type of infrastructure? Well, the answer these days is pretty much asset management companies like BlackRock.
BlackRock, not to be confused with the previously discussed Blackstone, is one of the most prominent examples of this transition to owning everything. BlackRock is not a bank. It doesn't take deposits. It doesn't make loans. It doesn't sell mortgages to families or credit cards to consumers. And yet, it has become one of the most powerful financial institutions in human history, quietly shaping markets, governments, and everyday life through ownership without responsibility and control without accountability. Founded in 1988, BlackRock began as a niche firm focused on fixed income investing and risk management. Its founders, led by Larry Fink, believed the future of finance would belong to those who could measure risk across increasingly complex portfolios. That belief turned out to be prophetic. By 2025, BlackRock managed roughly $12.5 trillion in assets, more than the GDP of every country on Earth except the United States and China. When you include the assets it doesn't own but advises on, the figure swells closer to $15 trillion, roughly the size of the entire U.S. economy. BlackRock's reach is not abstract. It is a top shareholder in nearly every major U.S. bank and a major owner of America's most recognizable corporations: Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Walmart, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Coca-Cola, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Visa, MasterCard, and thousands more. It doesn't run these companies. It votes within them, quietly, permanently. This is a new model. Own everything, manage nothing, and collect influence everywhere. Unlike banks, BlackRock is lightly regulated. It invests other people's money, pensions, insurance pools, sovereign wealth funds, central banks, so it avoids the capital requirements and scrutiny applied to institutions deemed too big to fail. It is a firm few people can describe, but as Larry Fink signals here, one that touches almost every corner of the global economy.
I think it's enormous. I mean, we made a strategic study in 2023, and this is why we did these three acquisitions. We did GIP. We believe infrastructure is just at the beginning of a golden age. And I'll get into that. We believe private credit will continue to grow and evolve. We did HPS.
That's HPS.
But also, we believe that if you're going to be, if you believe there's going to be a melding between public and private markets, which we believe that's going to happen.
What does that mean?
Meaning portfolios are going to have both private markets and public markets. There's a possibility that the government, the U.S. government, is going to allow in their fine contributions more private markets into D.C. But the foundation of that is going to be is data and analytics. So we bought Preqin, which is the smallest of the three deals, but it could be as impactful as any of them in terms, because I think more and more people are going to need analytics and data to justify the blending of public and private together in a portfolio. So we look at all three as a major component of our long-term strategy. Related to infrastructure, we believe that there's a need for trillions of dollars investing in infrastructure related to our power grids, AI, the whole digitization of an economy. We are still going to be investing in decarbonization. So all these different investments.
Well, they go together, don't they?
They all go together, plus making sure that we have adequate dispatchable energy. So all of this is all part of a plan.
BlackRock's power isn't just in what it owns. It's what it knows. At the center of the firm is Aladdin, a risk management platform that functions like an X-ray machine for the global finance system. Aladdin runs thousands of stress tests every day, modeling how wars, rate hikes, housing crashes, and liquidity shocks ripple through portfolios. Today, it monitors more than $18 trillion in assets used not just by BlackRock, but by pension funds, insurers, central banks, and even BlackRock's competitors. When you use Aladdin, you see the world through BlackRock's lens. That lens became indispensable in 2008. When the global finance system seized up, the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve turned not to regulators, but to BlackRock. The firm was hired to manage toxic assets from Bear Stearns, AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Citigroup. Throughout the crisis, Larry Fink was in constant contact with Timothy Geithner, Hank Paulson, and Ben Bernanke. According to public records, Fink spoke privately with Geithner more than 100 times during his tenure. The message to markets was unmistakable. BlackRock wasn't just surviving the crisis. It was helping design the recovery. BlackRock's advisory work during the crisis may have indirectly strengthened its market credibility and investor confidence, which could have helped in raising capital or negotiating deals. That credibility paid off. In 2009, while the public was still absorbing foreclosures and layoffs, BlackRock acquired Barclays Global Investors and its iShares ETF platform for $13.5 billion. Capital Barclays needed to fend off anxious regulators after the bank resisted a government bailout during the financial crisis. The cash would also help Barclays fund its acquisition of Lehman Brothers assets, a deal that completed in September 2008. Overnight, BlackRock became the world's largest asset manager and the dominant force in passive investing. As money flooded into index funds, BlackRock became a permanent shareholder everywhere capital flowed. But from the bird's eye view, there's much more to understand about this story. Back in 1988, Fink initially sought funding from Peter Peterson, who you may recall as a co-founder of Blackstone. He believed in Fink's vision, and Blackstone provided a $5 million credit line and seed capital to BlackRock. The fledgling firm was originally called Blackstone Financial Management before it spun off as BlackRock. Again, Peterson supplied political gravitas to the establishment of Blackstone. But we haven't yet discussed who Peterson was and where that influence came from. Peter G. Peterson, the eldest of three children to immigrant parents from southern Greece, was an investment banker. But prior to founding Blackstone, he was the chairman and CEO of Lehman Brothers from 1973 to 1984. Now, before his transition to investment banking, Peterson began at MarketFacts, a Chicago-based market research firm. He served as director of an advertising agency, McCann Erickson, in 1953, and later joined movie equipment maker Bell & Howell Corporation in 1958 as executive vice president, then chairman and CEO from 1963 to 1971. His background was business. Peterson wasn't an economist. He was a translator, someone who could spin economic turbulence into a story elites could accept. And in 1971, he took a sabbatical from his business career to serve in the Nixon administration, first as assistant to the president for international economic affairs. In April that year, Peterson produced a secret report for Nixon on the volatile world economy. The United States was facing inflation, trade competition, and declining industrial dominance. President Nixon didn't want a technical diagnosis. He wasn't searching for economic truth. He wanted a narrative that preserved confidence. Peterson delivered. On July 26, 1971, President Nixon and Peterson met in the Oval Office of the White House from 4:32 p.m. to 5:19 p.m.
With this being election year, labor unions are full head of steam, unemployment over 6%. This becomes a wonderful reason for a quota bill. And sometime we can talk a little bit about the quota bill, but the big concern I have about quotas versus other approaches is that they'll tend to freeze our industry into industries of the past. And while Japan and the others are putting their dough into the future, industries we're sticking with the past. Secondly, I don't think we've heard the last of Mr. Mansfield and friends. And if we have the worst balance of payments problem in years, I could expect defense cuts, withdrawing troops, aid, you know, the whole foreign policy thing could start getting in the way. And I've never quite understood why we should be making foreign policy decisions for balance of payments reasons. This doesn't seem to me to be appropriate. But that, and it leaves you weak politically, both at home and abroad, if you've got a terrible financial situation.
Over and over, the problem is framed as structural inevitability rather than political choice. Quotas are rejected not because they fail workers, but because they would freeze industry in the past. Labor protections are treated as electoral liabilities. Trade imbalances are discussed as abstract pressures, not as the result of policy decisions. What matters is competitiveness, confidence, and survival. Language that shifts blame outward and forward in time.
Which we could do on a temporary basis, we think. We'll probably require legislation, no, we're not sure of that. It's kind of an offbeat approach of European Jews that you may have heard of, where they put a heavy import tax on and then an export rebate, and they use that, as you know, as part of their value-added system. Now, the economists tell me that, as far as trade is concerned, it has many of the effects of devaluation. In the sense that you're cutting, you're just raising your, you're making your products less expensive and their products more expensive. But politically, in this kind of a climate, it feels a lot better to me. It feels like we could merchandise this as a certain amount of protection for our industries, a certain amount of export, you know, picking up. And instead of giving it a devaluation, we're doing it healthy. I think we could package this, if you follow me, in a way that can make it more like it. We're concerned about jobs. We are going to increase exports. And it's a temporary thing, which we think under the balance of payments rules of GATT we could do. And Lord knows people have been telling us we have a balance of payments problem. And Britain has done this once, and France has done it, so it's nothing as though it's not all that true. So that's an approach that, to me, I want you to know, I think we've got to keep this very secret, or we'll just, my God, if American business out here thinking about this, they import stuff because it, you know, be a lot cheaper. It's very much like it.
Here's what's missing. Wages, corporate pricing power, financial speculation, or the decision to dismantle post-war controls. Instead, Peterson emphasizes global competition and the need for flexibility. This is the soft launch of a new doctrine: discipline at home to reassure capital abroad.
One part of this is my discussion with Frank, and this part, you know, we're in a crazy world, but you stop and think about it. We're the only country that can be better. And you know, you like to take the long view here. But the way the rest of this world is moving, in Korea and Taiwan and Singapore and so forth, this isn't the last time this problem's going to come up. And I've been trying to figure out, why can't we do that? I mean, if you wanted to. Paul tells me, and he's absolutely right, I checked it out, that under the Bretton Woods thing, the president does not have the authority in this country without legislative authority to do that. Now, it may be that as part of a package at some point, we would want that authority. Now, the difficulty with this is, so it doesn't sound like you're going to do it, you know, soon. But some president of the United States should have the authority, because long-term, as president said, for you not to be able to do that, you're going to have to take all of the crap that we have to take on this subject year after year, and you're talking about our first building. I mean, everybody abroad takes a defense, and all of a sudden, your long-term strategies get thrown at home. And the truth of the matter is that if they have this problem, they see that, and they can distract you from some bad things. Okay, so without saying I'm sure I'm right, I guess what I'm asking for is authority to do a top secret thing on a bold approach to this problem, looking toward an August announcement, if it all works out well, with Conley, Schultz, and I'll add McCracken, and then just keep everybody else out of this, thing. But, yeah. I think this is a good idea.
There. Peterson proposes the idea of ending Bretton Woods. He acknowledges that the president doesn't have the authority, but as a part of some package, they would want that authority. He then requests approval for a top-secret plan, a bold approach with the target of an August announcement. Nixon pauses for a moment and then says, "I think this is a good idea."
Okay, so without saying I'm sure I'm right, I guess what I'm asking for is authority to do a top secret thing on a bold approach to this problem, looking toward an August announcement, if it all works out well, with Conley, Schultz, and I'll add McCracken, and then just keep everybody else out of this, thing. But, yeah. I think this is a good idea.
On August 15th, 1971, with Peterson's logic and justification, Nixon announces a series of economic measures implementing wage and price controls, imposing import surcharges, and ending the gold standard, unleashing an era of financialization. The through line is remarkable. Peterson helps end Bretton Woods, opening the door to financialization. He transitions to investment banking 2 years later, entering Lehman Brothers as chairman and CEO. After being ousted from Lehman, he co-founds Blackstone, and with the benefit of connections and influence, the company perfects private equity's extraction model. Blackstone seeds BlackRock, who scales that logic globally, advising governments, including helping design the 2008 economic recovery. They rocket to become the world's largest asset manager, owning everything and monetizing access to capital itself. Now, BlackRock doesn't need to run companies or pass laws. It sits above them, allocating capital, modeling risk, and shaping outcomes. It is the system born of the Bretton Woods collapse, one where capital governs states and ownership is separated from responsibility. This is not conspiracy, it is continuity. And it explains why in a world where housing becomes an asset class, pensions chase yield, and governments outsource judgment to algorithms, BlackRock doesn't feel like an aberration. It feels like the endpoint of a clear path from 1971 directly to today. A century ago, the center point was the factory. Today, it's the platform, the network, the patent, the franchise, the landlord's ledger. In that world, a company prospers by owning the right choke points. Own the bottlenecks, lease the flow. Your risk declines as everyone else's dependence grows, the same thing that was warned of governments. There are other choices. We can build more, faster, denser, smarter, where people actually need to live. We can re-legalize small apartments and missing middle homes. We can make public and cooperative housing dignified, abundant, and permanent. We can shape rules for platforms so that homes don't disappear into tourist inventories and corporate enclaves. We can tax what is extracted rather than what is earned. We can tilt the balance back towards belonging. But first, we have to understand the machine we're inside, the image itself. Drive through the entry of a prototypical build-to-rent community. A tasteful sign, gently curved street, a leasing office that looks like a boutique hotel. The homes are detached or paired townhomes. Clean lines, repeating elevations with just enough variation to feel personal. Every kitchen is a photograph. White shaker cabinets, quartz counters, laminated vinyl plastic flooring. Every garage has a sensor, every door a smart lock. The lawn care is included because uniformity is part of the brand. At the center, amenities. A pool with cabanas, a gym that would shame the old apartment complex you knew in your 20s, a dog park with turf engineered for drainage and easy cleaning, a co-working lounge where ring lights glow through the afternoon, package lockers that ping your phone, a calendar of community events, yoga, food trucks, trivia. The lease is digital and payments are automatic. Fees are layered. Pet rent, smart home package, trash valet. Repairs route through an app, and renewal notices reflect an algorithm's appraisal of your alternatives. You are both tenant and telemetry. To the investor, this is a symphony of predictability. Turnover is lower with a dog park. Repairs are faster with standardized parts. Bulk contracts on landscaping fixed costs. A 97% occupancy rate across 5,000 units reads like a bond coupon. If markets wobble, rent grows slow, but the checks don't vanish. The asset doesn't sit empty waiting for a buyer. It hums. Scale the model up and you see the outline of a new city. Residents who rent from homes from one company drive on roads maintained by another, work in spaces built by the hour, stream entertainment from a platform, store their files in someone else's server barn, and sometimes get their healthcare and schooling in systems that partner with the public purse but answer to private boards. Every layer, an account. For many, this may sound nice, and it may work. Until it doesn't. Until the rent spikes, until the job stutters, until the subscription stack consumes the raise you thought would change your life. Until the app logs you out of your own front door. Until you bristle against the company's interests. Return to the short-term rental shadow. In markets without thoughtful rules, the conversion of long-term units to short-term stays can hollow a community out. It's not just fewer apartments. It's fewer students stabilizing a school's enrollment, fewer year-round patrons for small businesses, less predictability for transit planners. The access economy is nimble, yes, but it can be predatory when its incentives collide with public needs. Where policy is weak, place becomes a product on someone else's calendar. And here, Brett Christophers highlights other outcomes when everything runs like a business.
If your incentive is to own infrastructures and housing with a view to selling them and making a profit, you have two or three specific incentives that I think make them inappropriate. Firstly, your main goal is to increase the income you extract from those assets right. as quickly as possible right. to make them more attractive to other potential buyers, which means putting up rents, putting up water rates sure. and so on. But the other thing is, if you know that you're not going to be owning that infrastructure in 10 years' time, let alone in 20 or 30 years' time, you are, by your very nature, disincentivized to carry out long-term capital expenditure, long-term capital investment that will, for example, keep that infrastructure in good shape for 20 or 30 years' time. Mm. You're much more likely to be inclined to carry out kind of like band-aid, sticking plaster type solutions, which keep those infrastructures in okay nick for the next few years, but then basically lumber the next owner with those problems. And if you look at the, many viewers will have heard about the lamentable state of UK water and wastewater infrastructures, yeah. which have been significantly owned by asset management institutions in recent times, including Macquarie from Australia, owned Thames Water for a long period of time. And that's just a case study in underinvestment in the infrastructure, right. alongside massive extraction through dividends and so on and so forth of income.
Even after the asset finds its long-term operator, the market is extraordinarily good at delivering convenience to those who can pay, and extraordinarily bad at guaranteeing dignity to those on the fringe or that can't pay altogether. The ledger balances for shareholders, not for neighbors. While the invisible hand does its work, the invisible heart withers. Public goods exist to hold the line against that drift, to ensure the water flows, the bus arrives, the park remains free. The home is not only a product, but a platform for our life. Privatization can rescue broken systems, yes. Unfettered, it can also make dependence permanent. The difference is not ideology, it's design. Some defenders argue that modern finance has evolved, that natural market discipline, the democratization of investing, and a flood of tradable products now keep power in check. Asset-backed securities, dividend flows, and index funds, they say, spread ownership widely and tie institutions to the public interest. Ordinary workers, through retirement accounts and pensions, become beneficiaries of the same systems that dominate markets. Responsibility, in this telling, is no longer imposed from the outside. It's baked into the portfolio. While it's a powerful story, reality doesn't quite work out that way.
The first of those is like, well, yes, but if those funds are making profits for ordinary retirement savers by investing money in a fund that is itself making money by ratcheting up rents on other workers or even potentially the same workers, then I'm not particularly sure that's a good thing. And I'm not sure I would want my pension to be boosted by essentially kind of rent gouging other people. So that's one thing. Second thing is, increasingly, the money that the funds like BlackRock and Blackstone establish, it is not the money of ordinary retirement savers. Increasingly, it is the money of institutions like huge sovereign wealth funds from the Middle East. So, for example, Blackstone's biggest infrastructure fund, which has about I think just over $20 billion US dollars invested in it. Half of the capital in that fund is the fund of one sovereign wealth fund, which is the PIF, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, where there's all sorts of questions about human rights and so on. So if that fund makes money, well, they're doing it, they're making the money mainly for Saudi Arabian government. So that's the second thing. Third thing is, yes, some of the rest of the money is retirement savings, but like all forms of wealth, retirement savings wealth, so pension wealth, is unbelievably unequally distributed in society. I think if you look at the US, something like the 50% of all retirement savings are held by, I don't know, the top 2% of the income.
Yeah, the highest income earners.
Yeah. So, yes, if Blackstone or BlackRock's funds perform well, some of the money that is the profit that is generated by that fund goes to ordinary workers, but it's a tiny, tiny sliver.
And the logic of access didn't stop at the city limits. It moved outward, mile by mile, until it reached the fields. Early in the shift, the relationship to land changed. and history should have rung alarm bells. More and more farmers stopped owning the land they worked. They leased it. The risk stayed with the farmer, however. The upside drifted elsewhere. Strip away the apps and LLCs, and the arrangement starts to resemble an older system Americans like to believe we left behind. Sharecropping. The laborer works the land, shoulders uncertainty, and pays a cut to the corporation whose connection to the soil is purely financial. For generations, the bargain was different. Farmers absorbed volatility, weather, pests, market swings, and government softened the edges through subsidies and insurance to preserve continuity, affordable food, productive land, stable rural communities. Ownership mattered because stewardship mattered. That balance is breaking. Today, farmland is increasingly treated as an asset class. Pension funds, private equity, REITs, family offices, and platforms acquire land not to farm it, but to hold it. An inflation hedge, a predictable lease stream, a securitized yield. If you own the ground, you don't gamble on crops. You rent the right to farm and collect the check. The product isn't food. It's access to the soil that makes food possible. A demographic cliff also accelerates it. The average U.S. farmer is over 60 and many have no successor. Over the next two decades, an estimated $24 trillion in farmland and agricultural assets is expected to change hands, one of the largest land and wealth transfers in American history. Step onto a country road and the new order is visible. Fields leased by the acre. The farmer works the land and owns none. When a storm wipes out a season, the farmer takes on the debt. The landlord's income remains. Risk is localized while profit is extracted. Platforms grease the transfer. Farmland REITs and marketplaces turn acreage into a product. AcreTrader, for example, sells shares in entities that own farmland. Farmers may still work the fields, but as tenants or minority stakeholders, while ownership migrates upward. And this system is politically connected. J.D. Vance, backed by Peter Thiel, invested in AcreTrader via NARA Capital before entering the Senate. He may not run the company, but the investment is emblematic. Populist language paired with platforms that financialize land and convert farmers into renters. Billionaires like Bill Gates, owning hundreds of thousands of acres, draw attention. But Gates is the headline, not the engine. The deeper transformation is structural. Ownership detaches from stewardship. Decisions move from kitchen tables to dashboards. Profits flow out of rural counties long before national statistics catch up. Meanwhile, small, diverse, regenerative farms continue to prove that they work. These practices aren't new. They're older than industrial agriculture. What they require isn't novelty. It's access to land and time. Because the great farmland transfer isn't just about acreage. It's about whether land remains something people belong to or something they rent back from distant owners. We can let the logic of access continue without friction, or we can bend it back toward the public good, build more housing where people need it, regulate where platforms undermine communities, revive cooperative and public options, and tax extraction built on scarcity while investing in reducing that scarcity. Mostly, we have to see the machine we're inside. If millions cannot buy, you can either make buying possible or make not buying profitable. In the short run, the latter path pacifies a problem. In the longer run, it cements a greater one. Economic and social pressures will continue to mount through the 2010s and 2020s. Local anti-housing campaigns, the development pipeline that produces luxury by default, gentrification and displacement, empty towers as safety deposit boxes, the creative class, and the way global capital treats homes as slots in a portfolio. Next time on Built to Divide.
Government is filled with moochers and loafers, right up to their ears, and they have a great idea. The object of a lot of them is to get the job and sit there till they get a pension.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
This is the White House, as seen from the South Lawn. We're in the state dining room, on the left of the screen, hidden behind the trees. There are three rooms which serve as reception rooms for the smaller official functions of the White House. The Red Room. Behind these walls, after the death of Willie Lincoln, Mrs. Lincoln consulted mediums and prevailed upon her husband to attend one séance. The Blue Room. Until recent times, this was the room where presidents received the credentials of foreign ambassadors to the United States. The Green Room. This used to be the dining room, and here Jefferson gave his famous dinners and introduced such exotic foods as macaroni, waffles, and ice cream to the United States.